The last time we spoke, it sounded almost as if Walt Whitman was pushing Shakespeare out of the zone almost.
I say, not quite. I say specifically at the opening of this work in progress, my equivalent of Joyce's Wake, Bloom's Wake, as it were, that the two figures who are threads in this labyrinth are William Shakespeare and Walt Whitman. And though I don't quite grant them equal status, I would be prepared to say that for what Shakespeare was for the Renaissance, Whitman was for the 19th century and after. Somebody who breaks the new road, which is what D.H. Lawrence wonderfully said of him.
For the 19th century and for the new world, in a way.
Yes, yes. He breaks the new road for the new world, and for better and for worse. The reason why English is now the lingua franca, replacing French, is because it's American English and it's American commercial dominance everywhere. Even though in the age of Benito Bush, as I like to call him, and insist upon calling him, that dominance may soon be called into question, as he has done everything he can to ruin our economy, to ruin our international standing, to ruin our armed forces. In fact, he is the decline and fall of the American empire all in himself. Mm. Our Caligula, our Nero, you name it.
Wow.
But he's not as colorful as those splendid rascals.
What does Walt Whitman have to do with it? How did he do it?
He invented his own persona more radically than his grand disciple Oscar Wilde did. He invented, quote, Walt Whitman, one of the roughs, an American. He was Walter Whitman Jr., the son of a rather truculent Hicksite Quaker, that is to say dissident Quaker carpenter out on the island, Long Island. He had a real flair from the beginning for journalism. Indeed, he had no formal education. It fascinates me that William Blake, whom Whitman came to very late, William Blake had no education whatsoever, formally speaking. He was autodidact, as Whitman was. But Blake was apprenticed to an old-fashioned engraver named Bassire. And that gave Blake the basic notion, which he never got away from, that as a writer, and indeed as an illuminator, as he called it, he would never deal with the printed page, but with an illuminated page, the engraved page, as it were. In the same way, Walt Whitman was apprenticed as quite a young child to a newspaper printer, and he learned the printer's trade, and his earliest memories were of setting type for a Long Island newspaper and then for the Brooklyn Eagle and so on and so forth. The basic look of the first Leaves of Grass, 1855, on the page, is indeed a newspaper of the time. Mm. And indeed, the very title, Leaves of Grass, which is a multiple figuration or pun, the grass refers, of course, to grass that grows. It refers, of course, to the biblical grass, which all flesh is grass and the fullness thereof. But it also refers to printer's jargon in the very offices that he was, as it were, instructed and brought up. Grass was simply throwaway stuff, odds and ends that you threw in order to fill up a page of type. So that's how Whitman got started. He became an extremely successful journalist. He moved to Manhattan and became a flaneur, a man about town, walking around like a sort of young dandy. So far as we can tell at that point, too shy to actually approach other men. And there may even have been flirtations with ladies, though how far they went, one can be prepared to doubt. He then suddenly and startlingly, in the earlier 1850s, upon being told that Papa was very slowly dying of cancer, and Papa was very tough and hung on for a while, went back home, lived with his father and brothers and his mother, worked at carpentry, which meant house building. They built whole houses and then sold them, and started to read fiercely and fanatically poetry, but also overwhelmingly Emerson. And as he beautifully said later, I was simmering, simmering, simmering. Emerson brought me to a boil. And under the impact of Emerson, though he was later to deny this because he wanted to be original, and he was feeling, you might say, to coin a phrase, some anxiety of influence, he insisted he never read Emerson, which is simply not true. He first came to notice because he took the very first copy, since, as you know, he printed and bound and set in type each separate volume of the first edition of Leaves of Grass. And he took the very first copy he finished and he mailed it off to Concord, Massachusetts, to Ralph Waldo Emerson. And 10 or 11 days later, and I think it's the most astonishing act of literary criticism in the history of the United States, perhaps of the modern world, Emerson, having carefully read this, I don't know what you or I would have made of it if it had come out of nowhere, this strange-looking book. I mean, I have turned its pages in the Beinecke Library and in the Berg Library in New York, in the 42nd Street Library, and marveled at it. It's an extraordinary-looking volume. Comes out of nowhere. Emerson sits down and carefully reads through it, is convinced that this is absolute greatness, and then sends this extraordinary letter to Whitman saying, I greet you at the beginning of a great career, and praises the work as having more wit and wisdom than anything else that has come along in America, which I think is still true. Emerson never withdrew the praise, though he admitted some later reservations. He rather grumpily said later on, I expected him to make the songs of a nation. He has been content to make the catalogs. But he was talking about the later Whitman by then. Whitman is a poet basically of 10 years, as Wordsworth, the only comparable 19th century figure, at least in English, is a poet of 10 years. Everything that matters of William Wordsworth is written from 1797 to 1807 in a great decade. There's the embarrassment that Wordsworth lives for 43 more years, and you couldn't get three pages of poetry out of it that you would want to read now, though my friend Jeffrey Hartman always gets angry when I say that, out of his loyalty to Wordsworth. Whitman, it's all one great decade also, 1855 to 1865. The heart of Whitman is four volumes, Leaves of Grass, 1855, which has Song of Myself, and The Sleepers, Leaves of Grass, 1859, the second edition, which adds the magnificent Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, at that point called Sundown Poem. Leaves of Grass, 1860, which has the two great Sea Drift elegies, As I Ebb with the Ocean of Life and Out of the Cradle Endlessly Rocking, Drum Taps, in particular with his supplement, which has the Lilacs elegy. Those six longish poems are the heart of Whitman and his contribution. And there is nothing like them ever written by an American. It's not only the crown of New World literature in any language, Spanish, Portuguese, Canadian or West Indian, French, American Yiddish, since all the best Yiddish poetry and, in fact, novels were written here in this country, at least after the classical ones. If asked to speak about the arts in the New World and the arts in the evening land, the United States, then I would say Whitman above all else. And if you want a second figure, then Louis Armstrong. But Whitman is an astonishing figure.
Even I feel the magic in Walt Whitman, and I guess every school child can. But what is it that obsesses the great critic and gets him gets him into the pantheon with Shakespeare?
Well, even though he echoes Shakespeare in Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, where there is a deliberate, rather powerful allusion to one of Edgar's speeches in King Lear, and he frequently echoes Shelley, and he is always, in effect, revising Emerson. But the extraordinary originality of Whitman, the so-called free verse, is in fact a return to biblical poetry. He was raised a Hicksite Quaker, more even than conventional Quakers, the followers of Elias Hicks, who was, by the way, 50% Native American, 50% African American, and who was a circuit rider who had broken with the Philadelphia Quakers and gone back to the spirit of George Fox. Hicks was a very fiery preacher, and his parents took the young Walt to hear him. And in Specimen Days, Walt talks about this. He was ignited first by Hicks. The basic mode of Leaves of Grass follows a sort of Hicksite Quaker formula. You stand up in meeting and you testify. And I know Walt says this, and I know that, and I know that my spirit is this. That's Quaker testimony of the extreme Hicksite kind. But the mode of biblical parallelism, Whitman takes it from the King James Bible. The Psalms, the prophets, the great poems in Job, the song by the sea in Exodus, the great war song of Deborah and Barak in Judges 5, Hebrew poetry depends upon parallelism. First, you use a particular phrase, then you use a matching phrase, which gets even more figurative. And that's the basic pattern of Whitmanian so-called free verse. It is no more free verse than biblical parallelism is free verse. So Whitman returns us to biblical poetry, though not to biblical belief, because Whitman is neither Judaic nor Christian. He is a Whitmanian. He believes that indeed, in fact, he is the poet of what I've learned to call the American religion. And I think he is the prophet of American religion right down to this day. And I think that American religion has very little to do with historical, theological, European Christianity, but is something indigenous and very new in the world, for worse and for better and for worse. But even more radically than that, perhaps, Whitman redefines the self, in which the self, the soul, and the real me, or me, myself, I'm using his nomenclature, are three separate parts of the human entity. And his problem is how you reconcile and fuse the three, and he discovers he cannot fuse them. And involved in that also is his extraordinary sense of how complex human sexuality is. Even though these days, and I find this very tedious, most Whitman scholarship and criticism and most Whitman teaching that goes on in the university is gay, 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 gay. But this is really very tiresome. The Whitman who comes through in Song of Myself and in a poem like Spontaneous Me, and indeed even at the opening of the Lilacs Elegy, is profoundly autoerotic. In fact, his muse is onanistic. He writes about masturbation. He is the most evasive, elusive, delicate in his effects, endlessly subtle and hermetic of poets. He keeps shouting at us, I will tell you absolutely everything, come closer, I will strip everything away and expose myself. He tells us not a thing that we can trust. And in fact, though he insists that he writes for common people and for folk in general, and that he will not offer anything that all will not understand, he's nothing of the kind. He is an immensely difficult poet. But he is, in fact, and this is the ultimate irony, perhaps, he is the greatest of formalist poets in the American tradition. Fantastic. His structures are immensely formal, in fact, almost Baroque. So Whitman is the heart of American literature. And more than that, I think he's the heart of the American character. He's the heart of our hope for what he calls democratic vistas, which God knows we don't have now. We're not a democracy. We are one-third a plutocracy, one-third an oligarchy, and one-third a rapidly burgeoning theocracy. But there's not much Whitmanian left in the public sphere.
Harold Bloom, you're a famous memorizer. What is the Whitman that you'd recite for us that comes to your mind in the middle of the day or the night?
Well, it can be almost anything. I suppose in particular, it would have to be the Lilacs Elegy. A child came to me and said, "What is the grass?" I could not answer the child. I do not know what it is any more than he does. But then suddenly he starts to answer magnificently, and he says, "I guess it is the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven," which is wonderful. And then he goes on to talk about it as, in effect, vegetation which is growing up out of the dead. Old mothers, old fathers. It's an extraordinary passage. And it has in it, suddenly, the most Homeric line that anybody has written since Homer. Staggering line, which you could swear must be in the Iliad or the Odyssey. "And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves." Isn't that an astonishing line? Mm. Sometimes his single lines are poems in themselves. He is observing a woman in childbirth in Song of Myself, and he writes, and he is thinking of, you know, the womb opening. "I recline by the sills of the invisible, flexible doors." Isn't that stunning? Mm. "I recline by the sills of the invisible, flexible doors." Mm. If that is not formalist poetry, then nothing is.